From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
What or who should America look like? Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. President Trump wants legal immigration based on high skills and earning potential, not on family ties, and he'd reduce it by half. But high-skilled workers may not show up if they can't bring their families, and the economy may need more low-wage workers than it can produce. Beyond economics, this nation of immigrants has welcomed newcomers from all over the world with the goal of diversity. Will that be replaced by assimilation as America's existential question heats up again? Later on today's Talking Point, America's conquest of English is creating waves in the United Kingdom. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The president says legal immigration should be cut in half with green cards based on merit and not on family connections. Would the U.S. survive as a nation of immigrants if it only admitted the best and the brightest? That's our main topic today. On our Talking Point later, spoken English around the world is sounding more and more American, even in England. Is it all about TV shows and movies or imperial power? First, this news update. The Washington Post reports that North Korea has crossed, quote, a key threshold on the path to becoming a full-fledged nuclear power. It's miniaturized a nuclear warhead so it can fit inside a guided missile. Robert Litvak was director of nonproliferation on President Clinton's National Security Council staff. He's currently at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Robert Litvak, welcome.
Thank you.
Is this a surprise? Do you believe it?
The report in the Post, based on the Defense Intelligence Agency's assessment, has been expected. Let's put this in context. I mean, North Korea has threatened to strike the United States with a ballistic missile tipped with a nuclear warhead, and one that could potentially detonate on the U.S. homeland. This is a complex set of integrated technologies. In July, they did two ballistic missile tests of intercontinental range. They demonstrated that technology. Now, the Defense Intelligence Agency has concluded that North Korea has mastered the miniaturization of a warhead. That is, that they can fit a warhead atop that ballistic missile. The third leg of the stool is the reentry phase and guidance. And in their most recent ballistic missile test, a Japanese source picked up that the reentry vehicle burned up. So that's one critical component that they've not yet mastered. But it will take them some time to do so. It took the United States, it took China, other nuclear powers, years to develop these capabilities. It will take China and North Korea time for additional testing to develop a reliable capability.
Everybody can understand how we know that they have long-range ballistic missiles, but how do we know that they can miniaturize nuclear warheads it's obvious that they're having trouble with the reentry, but what about the miniaturizing of the nuclear warheads? How do we know that?
Well, it's a good question. They've not done. There's not the observable evidence that you have during a ballistic missile test. I think that the euphemism "national technical means," that is, intelligence sources and reasonable surmises that the intelligence community has made, or in this case, it's the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's not the entire intelligence community. It's just one institution within that large complex has concluded that they've mastered miniaturization, but it's based on their assessment of technology that North Korea has acquired and conceivably fabricate harness to miniaturize warheads.
The Washington Post says that the U.S. has calculated that North Korea has 60 nuclear weapons. Does this mean they're all miniaturized, all ready to go?
That's uncertain, and that's a high-end range 60. I mean, the estimates of numbers of nuclear warheads is based on projections of how much weapons usable material, that is plutonium and highly enriched uranium, that North Korea could produce. The lower end projections are in the 20 range. The concern is that if North Korea stays on its current trajectory, that by 2020 they could have as many as 100 nuclear warheads. That's about half the size of Great Britain's force. And consider that North Korea is essentially a failed state. It's got a paltry economy, a mere $40 billion, which is the size of Dayton, Ohio. And this is in a region with trillion-dollar economies like South Korea, Japan, and China. So it's got an economy that is the size of a medium-sized U.S. city, potentially with a nuclear arsenal half the size of Great Britain's. And that would have been unthinkable when I got into this field.
You said that there still is time before they finally develop the ability to use this technology in a way that would be destructive. What can we do in the meantime?
Well, I think there is time for diplomacy to alter the, if I can use the metaphor, the trajectory of North Korea's program. They do need to do additional testing to master the reentry phase and to integrate these complex technologies. I think that creates political space for diplomacy, the focus of which would be on capping North Korea's capabilities, not fully rolling it back.
Was it a good idea for the UN Security Council to impose sanctions?
I think sanctions are an instrument. I mean, they are not a strategy. And the Trump administration has said that their strategy is maximum pressure. Well, if the maximum pressure can be combined with an engagement track, diplomacy, in other words, that could be focused on in the near term. Just preventing a bad situation from getting worse, capping North Korea's capabilities at their current level, say 20 nuclear warheads, and preventing, blocking through a freeze, the additional testing that North Korea would need to do to master the reentry phase. I mean, this is a critical capacity that they need to master to be able to threaten the United States.
All right, Robert Litvak, it's great to have you on our program. We'll hear more from you, I'm sure, as this story develops. Once again, at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, what or who should America look like? This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. President Trump is supporting a new Senate bill on legal immigration. It's called the RAISE Act. That's R-A-I-S-E. It stands for Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment. Here's how the president contrasts it to current procedures.
For decades, the United States was operated and has operated a very low-skilled immigration system, issuing record numbers of green cards to low-wage immigrants. This policy has placed substantial pressure on American workers, taxpayers, and community resources. Among those hit the hardest in recent years have been immigrants and, very importantly, minority workers competing for jobs against brand-new arrivals. And it has not been fair to our people, to our citizens, to our workers.
Dara Lind is immigration reporter for Vox News. Good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
Does the bill that the president is advocating correct the issues that we just heard him raise?
Well, it's important to realize that this bill doesn't touch who's coming to the U.S. to work, right? Or it deals with who gets green cards, which are, you know, permanent residency in the U.S.
Okay.
It doesn't address the kind of separate question that's often raised about non-immigrant workers, people coming here on temporary work visas, which is often used to argue that American wages are being undermined. So possibly. But that said, what it does is set up a system where anyone who wants to permanently live in the U.S. is going to have fewer opportunities to do so just by, you know, having family members who are already here, and will instead have to demonstrate that they, as an individual, are qualified to contribute to the American economy. So it's likely to create a system where people who want to live here for good are being evaluated based on their skills.
Okay, you're talking about people who have family members who are already here. What about those we want to attract, such as the president has said, people who can speak English, financially support themselves and their families, have high skills that can contribute to the economy? What about those who want to come and can't bring their families?
Right. This is the problem. There's kind of this assumption that people are either coming to reunite with family members or they're coming because they're economically skilled, when in fact, people who are coming as family, you know, on family-based immigration whose relatives are skilled may also themselves have skills, and skilled immigrants who might want to come to the U.S. for work might not want to stay here permanently if they can't bring, you know, adult parents or adult children or siblings, that kind of thing. So this bill, by slashing family-based immigration and not raising permanent work immigration subsequently, an analysis actually finds that the countries that would be most affected by this would be immigrants from India and Vietnam, which are not necessarily countries that we think of as being low-skilled, to the contrary.
Well, what about the president's comment that by emphasizing low-skilled workers, we've put pressure on American workers and taxpayers and community resources, to use his language?
So the economic consensus is generally that the only group of immigrants who are – or sorry, the only group of American workers who are really harmed by new immigration to the U.S. are recent low-skilled immigrants themselves. So when President Trump called that out as being a particular pressure, he wasn't wrong. But there's kind of a political question there, which is that recent immigrants aren't exactly the ones who are, you know, who elected Donald Trump. They aren't the ones who are clamoring to restrict immigration. So it's something of an acting on their behalf when they don't necessarily want that change. As far as U.S.-born workers are concerned, there are a few economists, including George Borges out of Harvard, who argue that there is an effect on lower-educated Americans when new immigrants come in. But most of the economic community says that there is little to no effect or even a positive effect on wages when immigrants are able to come in and not only take jobs, but also consume and live in the economy and, you know, contribute to the economy as people who are buying things that others have made.
Okay. Senator Tom Cotton, Senator David Perdue introduced this legislation. They are both conservatives. The president welcomed them to the White House. Is there a chance that this bill might make progress in the Senate or in the House?
Not particularly. This isn't something that anyone was particularly clamoring for. Leadership in both houses has been really wary of touching anything on immigration. They think of it as a very difficult issue that there isn't a whole lot of political reward in doing, and they're already dealing with a lot that they want to do and not a lot of time. There is, however, a possibility that something on immigration is going to have to come up in the fall, whether that's funding for Trump's border wall or something happening that would strip protections from young unauthorized immigrants who were protected under Obama, and Congress would want to step in to fix that. If any one thing on immigration happens in Congress, there's going to be a call to kind of address everything that everyone wants. So this should best be understood as something of an opening salvo from the White House and the, you know, members of Congress like Senator Cotton, who think of this as an important thing, to say, if we're going to address immigration, we have to think about future legal flows. And in particular, we should be trying to restrict future legal flows into the U.S. in exchange for doing whatever we're going to be doing on the border and with some immigrants currently here.
Dara Lind, once again, immigration reporter for Vox News. Vivek Wadhwa is a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Mellon University Engineering School, and he's part of Silicon Valley. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be on.
You have written that this is, in fact, a good and timely proposal. Why do you say that?
Well, I'm very pro-immigrant, you know, and I don't see this bill in its present form getting anywhere. It needs to be substantially revised. But what I liked about it was that shifting the focus from the undocumented, unskilled to the skilled workers. It's a debate we need to have. For the last decade or so, we basically have forgotten the skilled workers. I mean, I've documented that there are more than a million skilled workers stuck in immigration limbo over here waiting for green cards. And the Democrats also have held the skilled workers hostage to the plight of the unskilled. So what this does is that it takes the discussion to a different level and says, okay, now let's talk about people who contribute to our economy, because ultimately it is about economic growth in America. What counted a century ago was labor and capital. Now it's about knowledge and innovation, and this is what's going to give America a boost.
What do you mean when you say that the Democrats have held low-income workers hostage to high-income workers, immigrants?
Well, what happened was that there were many chances to pass skilled immigration reform, but the Democrats wouldn't do it unless there was full citizenship for the illegal, undocumented immigrants. So now, the Republicans probably would have agreed to some level of amnesty or whatever you called it, but the Democrats insisted on full citizenship or nothing. Why full citizenship? Because these people will vote for the Democrats. So this is the debate that's been going on behind the scenes, why there was no progress on skilled immigration for the last 8 or 9 years.
Okay. Once again, this is a very controversial issue, often called the third rail of politics, with a reference to electric trains. And here we are already talking about full amnesty. Edward Alden is with us, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a new book, Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Good to have you on our program.
It's good to be with you, Mark.
My understanding is that you and Vivek Wadhwa are good friends, but that you disagree very seriously on this issue. Tell us how you disagree with what we just heard.
Well, I mean, I absolutely agree with Vivek on the need to recast U.S. immigration policy so we're giving higher priority to educated and skilled workers. I think that's clearly where the economy of the future lies, and the U.S. system is badly out of balance in that respect. We take about two-thirds of our immigrants because they have relatives here in the United States, not because they have a particular set of skills that the economy needs. The problem is this bill does nothing to achieve that goal. I don't want to mislead our listeners. What this bill does is it cuts legal immigration to the United States in half, from roughly 1 million immigrants, which we take annually now, to 500,000. It does nothing to increase the supply of skilled workers. That would remain roughly where it is right now, about 140,000 green cards a year, and that includes the families of skilled workers. This bill does not change that. It changes the selection criteria somewhat. But, in fact, all it really does is radically reduce immigration from all other sources, family-based immigration, refugees, the so-called diversity visa lottery. If you compare this to what the U.S. Senate passed just 4 years ago, the Gang of Eight bill in 2013, that bill would have roughly tripled access for skilled immigrants to the United States, would have done far more to fill the needs of Silicon Valley employers and others on the leading edge of the economy. So I just think there's been a lot of misleading discussion about what this bill would do in terms of encouraging skilled migration.
So, Vivek Wadhwa, you said that you thought there was a lot wrong with this bill, that you thought it was a good opening conversation. Do you agree that it would not, in fact, do what the president said, and that is increase the number of skilled workers? They'd stay the same.
Yeah, in the present form, there's no way that this will do it. But I see it as step one of a negotiation. I mean, for the first time, we have a bill on the table which is focusing on the needs of the skilled immigrants. And then also, you know, for example, this diversity lottery that Ed mentioned, 50,000 people randomly from certain countries. I believe that America is diverse enough. I'd rather have those 50,000 visas be saved for entrepreneurs who want to start companies over here. Imagine if we brought in 50,000 companies to America, what would that do for the economy? It would uplift all, and it would make people more, open to immigration. Right now, we've got a backlash, and we have Donald Trump in power because there was so much resentment, hatred about immigrants and, what America has become. So let's understand that, and let's do something that's more, sensible for our times. But definitely the numbers need to be increased. I agree with Ed on that 100%.
America is diverse enough, we just heard from Vivek Wadhwa at the Carnegie Mellon University. Jennifer Rubin is with us, writes the Right Turn blog for The Washington Post, conservative columnist. Good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
Is America diverse enough?
Well, I'm not sure what that means. What I do know is that as we've been talking, if the goal is to increase productive work in America, then you need both high school workers and low school workers. In fact, there's a very interesting piece today in the Wall Street Journal documenting our acute shortage of low-skill immigrants. In fact, we have had to wildly increase the number of so-called H-2A visas for agricultural workers. We have a worker shortage in the United States. That's in part because we are an aging population. That's in part because, as most industrial societies, we're having fewer kids. And that's going to create a problem. It's going to create an entitlement problem that creates a work problem currently. So the notion that we should throw our lot in with immigrant restrictionists who really have a pedigree that goes back to all sorts of noxious ideas of Malthusian economics and population control really misses the point quite badly. And I don't think this is a starting point for anything other than the Trump-like rhetoric about immigrants. I think a much more productive way of going about this would be to go back to some of those proposals that were made in the context of the Gang of Eight and revive them. After all, the Trump administration has been touting its success in getting control of the borders. The other half of that then should be that now that we have borders much more under control, according to the president, that we can begin to consider not only legalization for those people who are here, but increasing the number of legal immigrants. By the way, when you increase the number of legal immigrants, you decrease the number of illegal immigrants. So that's an important part of that effort as well. I would also add that I think the notion of the difference between a skilled immigrant and an unskilled immigrant is somewhat artificial. We have, 52% of all billion-dollar high-tech startups that have been founded by immigrants. Many of those people were not highly educated when they came. They were entrepreneurs. They were people who may have had a advanced degree, but many, many did not. So that's the benefit of immigration, is we get the best and the brightest, the hardest working from around the world who want to participate in the American dream. And saying that you have to be a fully formed high skilled worker before you get here is really cutting off our nose to spite our face. Those workers will go to China, they'll go to Canada, they'll go to other places in the world, and our economy will be the poorer for it.
Let me quickly, before we go to a break, go back to Vivek Wadhwa on this point. What about that? If Silicon Valley, where you're very much involved, has in fact been advanced by people with low skills or low educational achievement, then why do we want to keep those people out?
We don't. And Jennifer's citing my research, and I agree with what she said. However, what I'm saying is that we need to look at the immigration system afresh. Do we need to have, you know, all of these agricultural workers bring in their parents, their uncles and their aunts, their nieces and their nephews, and extended families? This is what the anti-immigrants are so angry about. Let's listen to them. Let's try to understand it. And let's look at the entire immigration system afresh in light of where the economy is today and where the world is moving to.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break, as I indicated. We'll hear more from Jennifer Rubin, from Vivek Wadhwa, from Daryl Lind at Fox News, and also from Edward Alden at the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll talk more about immigration, not just legal but illegal, although it's legal immigration that the president now wants to limit by half. What we found out is that it won't limit his proposal, his bill that he's approved of, won't limit by half of those that he wants to bring in the most. We'll take a very brief break after we continue this conversation. On our talking point, we'll talk about America's conquest of English. It's creating waves in the United Kingdom. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Foreman only back with To The Point. Talking today about legal immigration. President Trump has endorsed a bill that would cut it in half. And we are talking about skilled and unskilled laborers coming in or workers coming into this country. Edward Alden, back to you at the Council on Foreign Relations. Tell us, if you will, the difference between skilled and unskilled. What kind of jobs are we talking about?
Well, I mean, I think generally skilled immigration tends to refer to people with at least a bachelor's degree, those who would go into white-collar occupations or scientific jobs or management jobs. Unskilled tends to refer to people who might work in retail sales, in hotels, cleaning staff, farm workers, construction workers. But generally the divide is sort of, you know, those with bachelor's degrees and higher and those with high school educations are often even quite a bit less than high school educations. They're rough categories, but that's generally what we're talking about.
What's your take on this argument that we're hearing from Vivek Wadhwa that, in fact, we need the skilled workers more than we need the unskilled at this point, and we don't need their families?
I mean, there are a lot of debates over that among economists. I think there is a consensus that the U.S. system, if you compare it to every other immigration system in the world, the Canadians, the Australians, or Germans, or the British, we're far too heavily weighted towards family. This ability to be able to sponsor extended family members like brothers and sisters and parents and adult children, that's a reasonably unique feature of the American system. So I think there is a consensus that we need to shift more in a direction for bringing in people who are going to fill certain sort of employment needs. On the skilled versus unskilled, you know, the if you look at Bureau of Labor Statistics forecast, you know, the fastest job growth is going to be at the top end, people with a lot of education, and at the lower end, you know, personal care workers and home health aides and things like that. So there clearly are some needs at both ends. Americans, if you look at their educational level, tend to clump a bit more in the middle. So you can make a credible argument that we need both. There's a lot of debate, of course, over what the numbers ought to be.
Let me go back to Dara Lind, again, immigration reporter for Vox News. How did we get to this place where immigration is heavily weighted in favor of familial connections, not just children and parents, but grandparents and others?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that what Edward has said, that there's, you know, now a consensus that there needs to be more selection based on economic contribution, is partially correct, but that's mostly because there haven't really been the kind of threats to the status quo that we're seeing. There really are people, especially, you know, when the current immigration system was set up in the mid-1960s, family-based immigration was the primary way for immigrants, especially from Asian countries, to be able to bring families to the U.S. and settle here. And we're currently in a situation where people from some countries, from Mexico, from India, from the Philippines, for example, can theoretically sponsor their relatives to come to the U.S., but the backlog is so long that in practice, any kind of chain migration or the fear that's often brought up by Trump advisor Stephen Miller and others about, you know, people just being able to bring each other who can then bring their own relatives happens over a much more protracted period of time. But the immigration system is currently trying to weigh a bunch of separate things against each other. There are ways that you can come here if you're, you know, for humanitarian purposes, like refugees. You can come here to work temporarily or permanently, or you can come here because, you know, you have family here, and Congress and the American people decided that it's an important part of living and settling in America to be able to, like, have your family alongside you, that you're more likely to be able to settle down permanently if you have family here rather than having people you need to support back in your home country and feeling a need to, you know, make your money and then leave. So those, all three of those are kind of being forced through the aperture of immigration. And currently they're happening under separate streams. The point system would kind of try to meld them to a certain extent. But, you know, as we've been discussing, it would do so in favor of kind of discounting the idea that having, you know, parents of a, that having parents of adults or adult children or sisters or brothers could ever be something that would be really important to the life of a U.S. citizen or someone who's already living here, that's kind of a luxury, and that what the U.S. should really be focusing on is what that individual can do for the country.
Let me go back to Vivek Wadhwa. Why is it that native-born Americans can't do the skilled work that you want to see more immigrants who are highly skilled allowed in for?
Well, you know, when it comes to technology in particular, there's so many different technologies advancing now at amazing rates. And, you know, they're making it possible really to solve humanity's problems itself. I can get into technical fields like artificial intelligence, gene editing, and so on, but there are many, many new fields of science and technology. We want the best and the brightest from all over the world to come and do their magic over here. Let's, convene. This is what Silicon Valley has done. This is why it's the most innovative, one of the most prosperous places in the world, because we brought in people from everywhere. You need to have different types of thinking to be able to spur the type of innovation that happens in Silicon Valley. So this is why bringing in immigrants is important, especially in these high-tech, high-knowledge areas. And by the way, I'm completely for family reunification, but I'm talking about extended families. That I'm not sure bringing in your cousins is going to make you or America any better off.
So, Jennifer Rubin, back to you. What do you say to that? And what are the Gang of Eight proposals that you find more acceptable than what we're hearing now?
The Gang of Eight tried to look at all facets of the immigration problem. They're really separate things, and they, of course, ran aground trying to make people happy on all sides of the equation. There's the border problem, which the president is aggressively going after. There's the problem of what we do with people who came here illegally, some of them as children, as the Dreamers did. And there is a sense from a humanitarian standpoint that it would be an abomination to throw these people out, separating families and so on. There's the issue of temporary workers. We haven't talked about that too much. Had a very successful program in the 1960s, the so-called Bracero program, which brought in agricultural workers on a temporary basis. They didn't stay here permanently. They went back, and we didn't have these issues of family reunification. So there's an argument for that type of immigration. And then there's this debate about high and low end immigration. And I think until very recently, the anti-immigration community made the sort of effort to pretend that they were only in favor of limiting illegal immigration. And that's not true. They're really in favor of eliminating as much immigration as they can possibly get away with. And the point that we've been talking about is that we need legal immigration, especially high-skilled people. This does nothing for that. It doesn't increase them, whereas the Gang of Eight, of course, did increase higher-skilled opportunities or higher-skilled visas for people who wanted to come here. But I do think there's something that is a little peculiar here, and that is that the proposal comes out of the blue, as it were. It comes at a time where we have essentially full employment in this country. It comes at a time where the issue is how to increase productivity in America, how to unleash the depressed productivity that many debates about how it is going. The last thing you want to do in a situation like that, particularly when you also have a problem of entitlements, is to limit the number of workers, and particularly foreign workers who tend to be younger, more attached to the workforce.
Well, why do you say that the anti-immigration community, as you call it, wants to limit immigration as much as possible?
Because now they're saying so. They've sort of come out of the woodwork, and now if you read their literature, it's very clear that they really are looking to preserve American racial and cultural, I don't want to say purity, but the status quo. And they're very much opposed to what, in their minds, would be a dilution of the American population. They're quite candid about it now when you begin to draw them into arguments and discussions about legal immigration. And this includes Stephen Miller, for example. So I don't think it's any surprise, and I think they would probably even admit it at this point, that yes, they're really opposed to immigration period. And there's very little economic and moral justification for that, which is why they've hid behind the skirts of the illegal immigration argument.
Stephen Miller, the presidential aide who got into an argument about this at a presidential, or excuse me, at a White House briefing just last week. Edward Alden, back to you. To what extent do you think this is all mixed up in politics, and particularly these issues of race and ethnicity?
Well, I mean, I think it's mixed up in the larger politics that has to do with Trump's election. And it comes from a lot of legitimate concerns. I mean, there are an awful lot of Americans who have not benefited tremendously from the economy of the last couple of decades. And that has been coincidental both with expanded global trade, particularly China's entry into the WTO, and high levels of immigration. And so the Trump folks have a view, you know, if we're more protectionist on trade and we restrict imports, and we're more protectionist on immigration and we restrict competition for American workers, that will be good for Americans, it will limit the labor supply, it will help raise people's wages. It's a particular view of the economy that I don't really share. I think the future is where Vivek argues that it is, which is with dynamism, with creating new companies, with being on the leading edge of these new advanced technologies, and immigration really helps on that front. I mean, Stephen Miller, the press conference, made just what I thought was a kind of bizarre statement about, you know, taking the example of the city of Detroit, which has seen its population decline by 2/3 over the last half century, and saying, well, imagine somebody starts a new company there and the citizens of Detroit are going to have to compete with low-skilled immigrants for those jobs. Well, that's a ridiculous notion. What Detroit needs is more people starting companies and creating jobs. I mean, if there's any city in the United States that could use more immigration, it's Detroit. So, you know, Trump has a legitimate economic view of the world. I just think it happens to be the wrong one.
Daryl Lind with Vox News. What percentage of legal U.S. immigrants now are family members, and are they qualifying for welfare, as is often claimed?
So about 2/3 of the people who get green cards, and remember, you know, we're not talking about all immigrants to the U.S. We're the things that people usually call immigrants, people who are coming to the U.S. to live here for a certain amount of time. We're talking about only the people who are given green cards, given the right to stay here indefinitely. And 2/3 of those are coming in based on families. But there are rules already on the books saying that if you are either a temporary immigrant or you have a green card but have been in the U.S. for less than 5 years, you're not eligible for most welfare benefits. There are a couple of exceptions to that, mostly dealing with children. But for the most part, you can't come here and immediately start sucking up welfare. So, you know, the president has kind of used this as an applause line in speeches lately, that he's going to start preventing immigrants from getting welfare, which is a decent restatement of current law. And this bill would kind of reduce the few things that they are eligible for, and also prevent state and local governments from giving any public benefits to immigrants who have been here for less than 5 years, which is not something that exists in current law and arguably something that there would be a constitutional challenge over, because the federal government would be dictating what states can and can't do with their funds.
Edward Alden, back to you. Give us a little history, if you will, on legal immigration. It has been challenged at various times over the history of the country, and to what extent does it depend on the economics of the moment or the racial attitudes of the moment?
Yeah, I mean, this is not the first time in American history we've seen this debate. I mean, we had very high levels of immigration in the late 19th and early 20th century, and following World War I, fears over security that have some analogies with our current fears over terrorism and economic concerns as well, and at the time very much racial concerns. The Congress shut down the United States to immigration to a considerable extent. So we had a period of very, very low levels of immigration throughout the late 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. I often tell people I was born in the early 1960s. I was born in this strange period of human history when there were very few foreigners in the United States. The population, people born outside the United States in the early 1960s, was about 4.5%. I mean, today we're back up to 13%, which is roughly where we were in the early part of the 20th century. So these things have gone in waves before in U.S. history. So this is not the first time we've seen this kind of debate, and I think it's going to continue for some time now.
Yeah, Vivek Wadhwa, are you yourself an immigrant?
I'm myself an immigrant, and I started companies here. I I contribute to the U.S. economy, and I know what immigrants can do for America, and I know how important it is now moving into the future, because it's now all about knowledge and technology. It's all about now industries being disrupted and all sorts of new opportunities being created. We need the skilled, the knowledgeable people on our side more than ever to create jobs for everyone else. If we don't do it, we're going to be left out, and the rest of the world is going to keep rising. So this is a very important discussion to be having, and the timing is more important than ever.
Jennifer Rubin, you see this in terms of politics and the politics of race and national origin as well. Who are the people most likely to immigrate, to emigrate into this country, if in fact this bill were to pass?
Well, it's a little hard to say because, as we've all, I think, agreed, I don't think it's going to be passing in this form. One can suppose that a greater percentage, although in number, absolute numbers it wouldn't change, but a greater percentage would be these higher skilled workers. But in point of fact, as I said, we have lots of needs for low-skilled workers who don't come in through the green card process, who come in through temporary work visas and other mechanisms. So I think the marketplace does drive these things after all, and I think the notion that we only need high-skilled workers is really belied by the facts and by these sort of stopgap measures that we come up with in order to try to fill the economic needs that we have. And I think you know, we have to be very careful when we talk about cutting immigration or cutting back on immigration. If you take 500,000 people out of the U.S. economy, if you shrink the economy, you're doing to the country as a whole what Detroit has happened. It's not good to lose population. It's not good to lose population in enormous numbers. It means your economy is smaller. It means there are fewer people to buy and sell and work, and you're going backwards. Certainly, we've got plenty of room in America, contrary to the Malthusians. We're not overpopulated in the United States, and we do want people who are contributing at all levels of society. So I think the goal going forward, in my view, it should be, frankly, to increase immigration. I think we've done quite a bit on the illegal immigration front, and I think we have a need both at the low end and at the high end for increased immigration. And I don't really accept the notion, although I understand where it comes from, that we should sort of capitulate to the irrational fears and the economic illiteracy of Trump's base and say, oh, well, it's not really the fault of immigrants, but nevertheless, we don't want to rock the boat, so we're not going to let these people in.
Let me just make sure, Vivek Wadhwa, that's not what you're advocating, I take it, even though you're
supporting. That's not what I'm advocating.
Yeah, okay.
And I agree with Jennifer that we need to have low-skilled people, but bring them in on temporary visas. So there are solutions to the problem over here, but we do have to listen. We do have to understand why we have Donald Trump in power. It's because of this anger. Let's understand that.
And you got a lot of angry responses to your column in The Washington Post, supportive of the idea of starting to talk about immigration again.
Yeah, including my friends such as Edward Alden. I mean, so this is the way it is.
Edward Alden, you didn't write an angry letter to The Washington Post, did you?
I did not do that. I agree with Vivek on most things. I think he's wrong on this one, but we'll argue it out politely like we always do.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to be polite on this program as well, and I want to thank you all for being on it and giving us a good sense of all that is involved in this extraordinarily complex issue. Edward Alden, again, with the Council on Foreign Relations. His book, Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Vivek Wadhwa at the Carnegie Mellon University, distinguished fellow. Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post. Dara Lind with Vox News. Thank you all very much. And we'll talk to you all again, I hope. In a moment, the rapid spread of Americanized English on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Norman Alna here with today's Talking Point. There's a new book creating a stir in the United Kingdom called That's the Way It Crumbles, The American Conquest of English. As the vote for Brexit suggests, there is a nationalist trend in that country and an argument that British and American English are two separate languages that ought to stay that way. Rebecca Radil disagrees. That's based on her studies as a historian of 17th century England, when English settlers started coming here to the New World. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
There is new research about the Americanization of English entitled The Fall of the Empire. What's that about? You responded to that in an article in The Guardian.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating piece of research, actually, that has used Google Books, 30 million Google Books from 1800 until 2010, and also Twitter, and looked at geotagged tweets from around the globe to look at the patterns of, in the way that English is used, whether it's written in an American way or in a traditionally British English way, and how that has shifted over the course of a 200-year period. Well, 6 years on Twitter, 200 years on Google Books. And it's shown that American English has increasingly been influencing global English throughout the latter part of the 20th century, particularly, and specifically the last 20 years. It's also shown that American English, American vocabulary, has been feeding into the way that British people are speaking and the way that they're using English themselves, which is particularly fascinating.
You got 2,000 comments to your article online. What did you say, and what did the commentators say?
Yeah, well, it posed a kind of provocative question. It was whether or not the Americanization of English is a good thing or a bad thing. And of course, the answer is never, it's not clear-cut like that. But what I found particularly interesting were the ways, it's often implicit, but the ways in which the topic is approached. So in reviews for Engel's book, which I have to confess I have not read, but I will do, but in reviews for his books, there's lots of phrases that refer to British English as being as having once been a pure language and belonging to an innocent age, which I think is quite provocative in itself, because of course no language exists on its own, and English is no exception. It has undergone myriad changes throughout the centuries. There have been four key shifts, so to speak. The historians debate the actual decade that these came into place, but roughly speaking, there was Old English in the 5th century. That's the language of the epic saga Beowulf. Then there was Norman-influenced Middle English that appeared in the 11th century. And then early modern English in the 15th century onwards. And that was the language, that was the type of English that was taken over with the English settlers to the New World. So that was the language that the original settlers were speaking. Then there was another shift towards the end of the 17th century to what we accept as modern English today. But throughout that time, the language has been influenced by words and phrases from around the globe, and it's always evolving.
When the colonists brought English to the New World at the 15th century type, that was Shakespearean English, was it not? Or it was in his time?
Yeah, of course it was. And it's interesting at that time. I mean, I'm speaking to you now, and perhaps American audiences might be most familiar with what you would think of as a typical standard English accent, received pronunciation, and that's the language of the movie stars, the way of speaking of the movie stars like Tom Hiddleston and Benedict Cumberbatch. Well, I'm speaking to you with an accent, and most people in Britain have an accent, funnily enough. And that was absolutely the case in the 17th century. Most people were speaking with dialects. There was no uniform or standard way of speaking. So those settlers that travelled from various places across England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland to the New World, they took with them their regional accents, and they all blended together to create what would later become the American accent, but still, you know, there are various dialects within your country, even to this day, as there are in Britain as well.
There are, although they seem to be fading away with the mass broadcasting of television and radio. People are talking more and more of the same, and accents on a regional basis are disappearing. Well, what are some examples of the differences between what people are referring to as American as opposed to British English?
Okay, so just to give you some examples. So up until the mid 18th century, as I said, there were many, many regional dialects around. But at around about 1750, 1760s, a way of speaking in England emerged, and this was a way of speaking that was not where people were not pronouncing the letter R in the same way that they had done previously. It's called non-rhotic speaking. And the way you pronounce hard, for example, will be different to the way I pronounce it.
Hard. Exactly. I would say hard. What would you say?
Hard. So I don't pronounce that letter R in the same way that you do. And that emerged around about the mid 18th century, and it didn't arrive without comment. Americans coming over to England remarked on the strange way that English people were speaking. So there's a commentator called James Cooper, and he said he wrote that it's next to impossible for an Englishman to escape detection in America. Because of this specific way of them speaking. Kind of opposed to that, if an American at this point in time was to travel to England, the argument was that their accent would be blended and, you know, would be disguised by the various dialects that were still going on in England. So an American could avoid detection, whereas an Englishman speaking in this non-rhotic way would stand out like a sore thumb.
We've just got a minute left. Tell us about fall and autumn.
Yeah, okay, so fall is, to an English person, that's probably an Americanism, when actually, in fact, it's not. Fall was spoken by people in Britain before the first settlers.
When you're talking about a season rather than gravity.
Yes, yeah, the season after summer. In America now, you call it fall, of course. We refer to it as autumn, but actually fall and autumn were terms that were English in origin, and we were using them, only 300, okay. 400 years ago.
All right. Once again, I think the bottom line is that language changes constantly, and at the moment at least, statistically speaking, American English is spreading around. Rebecca Radil, it's great to have you on our program, and thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Orvin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.